there's a shadow curriculum that is being taught on the college campus that is outside the curriculum, outside the purview of what we in the faculty do. These are not really instructors or faculty. These are our functionaries. They're DEI functionaries who don't really know much of anything, but they're teaching these mandatory shadow curriculum seminars and caucuses. And so the fact that this is coming out now, I'm simply delighted and optimistic.
Hey, critical thinkers, welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Here, we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, and today we're talking with Dr. Stanley Ridgley, who is a returning guest from about a year ago. And we're actually talking about education because Trump has announced that he's going to be axing the Department of Education. Now, as critical thinkers here, education, we recognize is something that's very important. And so I just wanted to understand what the implications of cutting the Department of Education are and what it might be replaced with. What will it look like? So Dr. Stanley Ridgley is a professor of strategic management at Drexel University's LeBeau College of Business. He's the author of Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities. He's a former U.S. Army military intelligence officer who has served in West Berlin during the Cold War. He holds a PhD in international relations from Duke University and an international MBA from Temple University's Fox School of Business. And this is really cool. He has a course on a platform called The Great Courses, which is something I highly recommend for people who love to learn new things. And his course is Strategic Thinking Skills. How cool is that? Again, as critical thinkers, I mean, this guy is as good as it gets. But let's just get right into the episode. So without further ado, Dr. Stanley Ridgley.
Stan, it's good to see you again. I appreciate your time. And I told you this before recording, but I do want to say this again. I have your book here, Brutal Minds, The Dark World of Left-Wing Brainwashing in Our Universities. My audience knows that I talk a lot about propaganda and influence, Edward Bernays, Gustave Le Bon, even Noam Chomsky. And I think your book is really important for anyone interested in influence and propaganda to really read this book, Brutal Minds, because it lays, I mean, there's just so much in here, so much valuable stuff that really lays out some of the big problems with education. And, you know, the reason I reached out to you, at least in part, was because Trump recently announced he's cutting the Department of Education. And that's scaring some people. So I guess just to start off, what are your thoughts about that? Because you're a professor, so this must affect you.
Well, we managed just fine without a Department of Education. It was used to be called HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, until the Jimmy Carter era. And the Department of Education really did not change anything in higher education one whit, except to provide a gateway or a gatekeeper, I should say, function of lots and lots of funds. Its primary influence, as far as I know, is at K through 12. So I think that the announcement that Trump is looking at the Department of Education as a fruitful place where we can cut waste, fraud, and mismanagement, that's a good thing. If only because we're looking at it and we're considering it, we're scratching our chins, cocking an eye and saying, hey, is there something going on here that doesn't need to be going on, that doesn't need to be, a draw upon the national treasury? I think a lot of things are on the table that weren't before, not just the Department of Education. So I think that having someone who was more frugally minded with respect to the national treasury and the idea that the people who are earning the wealth of this country and contributing to this country in terms of tax dollars need to be thought of. Primarily, we don't need to look at all the Department of Education is doing great things. Well, it may be or may not be. Let's have a look. Let's have a look. Let's have a look at using the idea of zero-based budgeting. I know you know what zero-based budgeting is. We're going to start your budget from zero, and we're going to start finding out what it is you do, whether that's necessary. And then if it's necessary, we'll add to your budget. And that kind of process, which is very convoluted, takes a while, but it can yield some very salutary results. So I'm I'm very positive, very upbeat about this notion of looking at the Department of Education as a place where we can begin to trim the fat. If some of my colleagues are upset or fearful, well, then that probably shows that they don't understand or are perhaps, I should say, feasting at the trough of education, and that they feel themselves probably threatened financially. But I think it's great.
Well, you know, politicians say things all the time. They make promises that very often they don't keep. It sounds like you're optimistic, and that's good. I hope you're right. You know, so I have a list here of some of what Trump has promised. This is straight from his website. This isn't the whole list, but he made 10 particular promises on education, and I'm just going to skim down the list here. Parental rights and control. Parents should have comprehensive rights to oversee their children's education. Parents must be notified about classroom activities, guest speakers, and any attempts to modify their child's gender identity or pronouns. The fundamentals will emphasize reading, writing, and arithmetic over what he terms inappropriate racial, sexual, and political material. School choice, support universal school choice, allowing parents to select public, private, or religious schools. Remove critical race theory and gender ideology from schools. Focus on career readiness. So, I mean, that sounds good to me.
Going, it's fantastic.
Yeah, there's more, I think, on some, like, there was something, I don't have the rest of the list in front of me. I saved the most pertinent, but something about, like, sexual misconduct in schools is going to be treated more seriously, or they're going to approach it differently. So, I mean, that all sounds good to me. I guess, what makes you so confident or optimistic that this will actually happen?
Well, the fact that it appears on a list, it's in writing, and things that appear in writing tend to have a gravitas that toss off lines that, say, a campaign speech might not. It is not. It's perishable. And it tends to hold you to account.
Yeah.
I think that by putting in writing, there are lots of people who favor these particular policy prescriptions who are not going to forget that they were listed. And then, you know, 2 years down the line, it's going, hey, what happened to all of those great policy prescriptions that you listed on your website? No, I think that the president is focused on this. I think that the threat has been analyzed. And I think that the COVID situation back in 2019, 2020, which brought parents to their focused parents on what their kids were actually learning in high school by allowing them to monitor their kids' classes by virtue of Zoom, it really alerted a lot of people the fact that we live in a, like it or not, we live in a country where the education system, public education system, is government controlled. And that, coupled with the fact that teachers for the last 20 years or so have been coming out of education schools that were long ago politicized to the far left, without exception. And the primary theoretical or theoretician that is has pride of place in the pantheon of education schools is a Brazilian neo-Marxist by the name of Paulo Freire. And he was a great admirer of Mao Zedong. I have Mao Zedong on my coffee cup right now. Constantly remind me that he belongs nowhere in anyone's life except as kitsch on someone's coffee cup. That he was a great admirer of Mao's cultural revolution, the idea, not that you shoot the peasants down, but that you re-educate them. Well, Paulo Freire really admired this. And Paulo Freire, by extension, of course, has a hallowed place, along with a host of lesser known Marxists and neo-Marxists, self-described. It's not my appellation for them. They proudly state this. Not where you and I can hear them in the public square, but certainly in their literature back that they exchange back and forth. And so why is this important? It's because Paulo Freire kind of cribbed most of his education policies from Mao Zedong's education or re-education. And this is what pre-service teachers are learning in education schools. And they go down to the K-12 classrooms, and they're not subject matter experts like they used to be, meaning teachers used to be. My wife was a public school teacher, was a science teacher. You're versed in science. You're versed in math. You're versed in English literature. You're versed in civics. No, they're versed in theory. And they are in the business of utilizing social emotional learning to indoctrinate kids in high school, kids in pre-primary and secondary school. Now, this is a fact. It's not something that we're speculating on. This may or may not be happening. No, this is a fact. And I think that the Trump administration, by listing this on a wish list or a policy prescription list, is absolutely phenomenal. It is really ceding to parents primacy in their upbringing and the education of their kids. And I think recognizing that to a certain extent is absolutely necessary to rebalance the scales and to take power back away from the teachers' unions under people like, you know, Randy Weingarten and folks who believe that they are responsible for educating your kids, for not just educating your kids, but molding them as a whole person, creating a new man, a new person. This is really Soviet in nature. In fact, I have a vast library, given my academic focus was on the Soviet Union and Soviet ideology. The idea of crafting or reforming human nature was absolutely endemic to the Soviet philosophy. And I've got many books, one called The New Soviet Man, how through education administered by the government, and by turning kids against their parents ideologically, they would create a new generation ready for the struggles of equity of the future and that sort of thing. So I think that this list that you've described here is a recognition that that is what has been underway in American education, higher education for a long time, and of course, K through 12. I can't recall some of the specific things that you listed, but I think one of them was expunging CRT from K through 12,
which is critical race theory.
Yeah. And there's been a kind of a deceitful propaganda effort on the, we don't have CRT in secondary schools or in primary schools. Well, of course you do. It's called DEI. CRT is the theory itself. Then there's the application of the theory. No one is teaching how to do critical race theory in high school or in primary schools. That's true. What they're teaching is the applied version of a CRT, which is in the implementation side of the house, is DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, and sometimes belonging, where we are applying the lessons that we have learned with respect to a CRT. And this includes accusing white students as being complicit in a structural, systemic, racial society, a society that is governed by white supremacy. Unlike the defenders of this ideology, it's not a matter of simply, you're worried that we're going to teach someone the truth about slavery and the white students are going to feel bad about themselves. No, that's not the case. That's a fake proxy or a mask for what's actually happening. What is actually happening is white students are being accused by virtue of the color of their skin as being oppressors. And this condition of racism, they're inherently racist, cannot be fixed. It is something that you will have to be educated out of so that you can be on your best behavior. Otherwise, you will remain complicit in this overarching system of white supremacy, which is one of the greatest frauds I've ever seen. Now, I study these types of cons or frauds as part of the propaganda campaign. I know that you're probably familiar with one of the great forgeries of the 20th century, probably the greatest forgery. Greatest propaganda instrument, anti-Semitic instrument, was the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which was a forgery by the Russian secret police to basically utilize as a tool of oppression against their Jewish population in Russia and to conduct pogroms against the Jewish population. It was an incredible forgery that still has life, even to this day. Well, I consider one of the great forgeries of the 21st century, if not the greatest forgery, which is utilized nationwide in DEI programs and CRT, is something called the White Supremacy Culture Behavior List. It's a list of about 15 behaviors that identify white supremacy culture. Well, most people who see this, and let me just tell you that it is widespread. It is actually given out, distributed in a handout at the University of Michigan as part of their DEI program. They're one of the most egregious transgressors on DEI and this type of nonsense. Well, this list, where did it come from? Oh, surely it must have been well-researched. Certainly it must have a substantial body of research to undergird it. Otherwise, a university like the University of Michigan wouldn't be using it. No, that's not the case. It was completely fabricated in one evening by a disgruntled social worker by the name of, diversity worker by the name of Tema Oku in North Carolina. She was upset that the people she was lecturing to weren't accepting what she had to say about diversity. So she, in a fit of semi-rage, jotted down 15 behaviors that she thought exemplified this kind of reaction to it. Now, she acknowledged that this is the source of the list. She acknowledged it in writing in her own dissertation in 2004 at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. She made the list up. She simply fabricated the list off the top of her head. She says this quite clearly, distinctly, and yet this list that was made up by a diversity worker now has cachet simply by virtue of repetition. And so this is, I consider this one of the great frauds, cons of the 21st, probably the most egregious con of the 21st century. I'm focusing on this in my next book as well, elaborating all of this, explaining all of this, showing you where it's used. It's even used at the Duke University Medical School as an example of what the kind of white supremacy culture and behaviors we're fighting against. Things like, here's an example, individualism. We don't like that. Punctuality, being on time for work. We don't like that. Professionalism. We don't like that. That's a white supremacy behavior. So wait a minute. What attention to detail? They call this perfectionism.
I saw math. Math is racist too.
Math is racist as well. Professionalism, punctuality. All of these are racist. Basically, what she did was she contrived a list of behaviors that some people aren't good at and some people don't want to pursue in other words, to be successful in a modern information age society. And so what she was saying, and what the University of Michigan is saying, is that, well, you don't have to do that. This is all part of the white supremacy culture. You can reject that. You don't have to be on time. You don't have to pay attention to detail. You don't have to be professional, because this would be, you know, genuflecting at the altar of white supremacy. This is such, I'm not going to use any profanity, but it's really is BS, okay?
You can use profanity if you want. Feel free.
Bullshit, okay? And that is an academic word that was made cogent and academic by the late professor of philosophy at Princeton University, Harry Frankfurt, who wrote a famous essay called On Bullshit. And I encourage your audience to look it up. You can see it online. You don't have to buy it. It's a wonderful essay that shows the distinction between simple lying and bullshit, and there is a difference. Well, this is really the DEI agenda. CRT agenda is all grounded in bullshit. And I think that most people understand this at a kind of a visceral common sense level, but are afraid to say so. And so my work in Brutal Minds, the book that has been published, it's a wonderful book.
It is.
It's the fruits of my labors in exposing this type of nonsense that has paralyzed academia. It's paralyzed American business. It's paralyzed government to a certain extent, because people are so afraid of saying something that's going to get them accused of being a white supremacist or being a racist. And so we need to grow beyond that and tell these people to get off. And one hopes that these folks are losing their jobs or being reassigned to something more productive. My new book, which is basically focused on delegitimizing, I should say not delegitimizing, but showing how illegitimate DEI actually is, showing its rickety foundations, showing its foundations based on fraud. The type of thing that I just explained is going to, I hope, that will contribute largely to the awakening of our public. You and I have had a conversation in the past, recent past, about how people find it very difficult to believe that, you know, what's actually happening on the campuses, what's happening in K-12 is actually happening. And you'll get these knee-jerk responses. I said, DEI is just this. It's just learning about slavery. It's not. No one has any problem that I'm aware of learning about slavery. But the whole story about slavery needs to be told. The whole supply chain of slavery, beginning in Africa with the enslavement of African tribes of each other, and then selling their brothers and sisters into slavery. The idea of North African slave trade, the white slave trade, the idea that slavery has been around since humanity has been around. And the idea that is kind of glossed over, that Western societies, primarily the UK and the United States, led the way in abolishing slavery. where slavery still exists in many parts of Africa. That's the history of slavery. And no one is against, you know, telling that whole story. But you'll find, you know, the recent polls, I think, that high school students, many high school students, I think it's 41%, seem to believe that slavery only existed in the United States. And that's because of projects like the 1619 Project, the project not of an academic, but of a newspaper reporter by Nicole Hannah Jones, that this misinformation that people are really afraid to debunk or to show the entire story begins to hold sway. And that's the real danger of this educational system that's out of control, that has no accountability, is unable to govern itself. And I think that this is what we see with the Trump administration, bringing a level of public accountability and transparency to a process that has far too long been hidden from public view.
I don't know. You know, I'm a board certified health and wellness coach, and I saw this article that said fitness is equated to white supremacy. So I stopped teaching fitness at my business, and just a joke, obviously. But I do want to give a disclaimer. You know, I have no public political position. We're here talking about some of Trump's, you know, actions that he might take in education. You know, I don't state openly who I voted for, who I support. Although, to be fair, on Instagram, I did encourage people kind of half jokingly to vote for Ron Paul, who I heavily supported in 2012, who, funny enough, supports, like from the very beginning, said, like, cut the Department of Education, as well as basically every other agency associated with the government. So personally, I am optimistic, but I also do wonder, has the Department of Education done anything good? Because I've heard that before the Department of Education, we used to be performing very well when you look at the data and statistics. And then this department came along and now we're amongst the worst. That's undeniable. I mean, you look at the list, we're close to the bottom. Is the Department of Education to blame? Has it done anything good?
I can't speak to that. I'll be quite frank with you. I'm not going to begin to pontificate on you know, my personal opinions. I do have very strong opinions about that because I, like you, have a kind of a libertarian bent. And I believe that, you know, I'm a big fan of Albert J. Nock, who was one of the philosophical gurus for libertarianism. And I think the government that governs least governs best. And I think the government that is closest to the people governs best. And the farther that you get from local government, regional, you know, state government, regional government to the federal government, you get farther and farther and further away from actual policies that people support. You find suboptimal outcomes being negotiated by senators and Congress people. Or basically, it's called log rolling. You know, I'll put my pork in and you vote for it, and you put your pork in and I'll vote for it. And so you find ridiculous, nonsensical bills like the so-called border bill, bipartisan border bill that the Democrats basically flogged to death. So, well, this could have solved the border crisis had the Republicans. No, it wasn't a border bill. It was a Ukraine war funding bill, funding the Ukraine war by $60 billion. With less than a third of the same of that amount going toward some kind of border addressing, where it was not really enforcement of our laws, but you know, basically papering over and allowing 5,000 people a day through the southern border, if it exceeded that amount or that number, that then there would be some sort of enforcement. Well, one wonders why you wouldn't enforce a zero coming across the border, zero illegals coming across the border. So the idea that it was a border bill is absurd. And so that's the kind of absurd suboptimal outcome that I don't like when you see the federal government work.
You've tried the apps, you've signed up for gym memberships, and you've given it your all, yet you're still not where you want to be. What's missing? Accountability and expert guidance. As a board-certified health and wellness coach, I provide the personalized support that you need to finally make real, lasting progress. Making a solid health routine last and stay consistent is hard work, but you don't have to do it alone. Let's work together to turn your health goals into reality. Are you ready to transform? Start your journey at Avantia Health Optimization by clicking the link in the show notes or by going to mikevera.com, where you can try your first session for just $1. Now back to the show.
And this is the same for federal bureaucracies across the board, which is why, in principle, I do not believe that good things will come from the Department of Education. I do believe that a lot of people will be employed in government on the government payroll that probably don't need to be, and that they will vote reliably Democrat because Democrats want to expand the bureaucracies and Republicans, generally speaking, want to reduce that. Well, that's a direct an attack on the gravy train that these civil service employees are part of. And that's why the incoming administration's calls for reducing federal bureaucracy are making a lot of people squeal. So again, I go back to my idea of zero-based budgeting, which is really a course and brutal exercise that you don't want to do all the time, but it does concentrate the mind wonderfully. And it really requires people to say, I don't believe that my position ought to be cut because I contribute this, this, and this. And finding out what these bureaucrats actually do with their time during the day would be a wonderfully transparent and illuminating exercise for all concerned, both people who like the Department of Education and people who don't like the Department of Education. I will say that what we have in the United States with regard to scores, with regard to achievements, with regard to social promotions, looking at the K-12 bailiwick, we have been in decline. We have been in decline for a good 20 years. It may be coincident with the Department of Education, but it's also coincident with a lot of other things. And I think that teaching, the preparation of teachers for secondary, that's far more important than I think that a lot of, than an amorphous federal agency. You can really track, and I do track, the preparation of teachers who then go down into the K-12 environment. And instead of teaching basics of living in a complex information age society, reading, arithmetic, social studies, government, history, that they're basically teaching attitude development, teaching social emotional learning. And that's a form of brainwashing, by the way. We heard this term social emotional learning. It's basically taking people and attacking their belief system, whether it be at the higher education level, attacking students and faculty and staff, and then trying to replace or manipulate that belief system. Much more successful at the K-12, because these are young people who are still learning, still developing, and teachers are intensively, intentionally, purposefully attacking the student's belief system and trying to instill and install a belief system that they themselves believe is appropriate for what a young person should know today, not what your parents have taught, not the values, the morals, the traditional upbringing. No, none of that. This is more along the lines of Paulo Freirean equity, neo-Marxist collectivism, the kind of, you know, and certainly not anything on that list of white supremacy behaviors, individualism and punctuality and attention to detail, the idea of working to achieve a goal and create wealth for yourself and your family. No, you work and achieve for the greater good. And this is the collectivist dream that has always mesmerized folks on the left when it's actually a chimera. It's just a dystopian type of future.
You talk about like challenging students' views, and isn't that kind of inherent to education?
Well, it depends on what level you're talking about. When you're talking about, kindergarten, you're talking about the kindergarten, you're talking about first, second, third, fourth grade. We're basically, you're trying to teach young people the basics of how to go about living. You're trying to teach them the fundamentals of math, the fundamentals of arithmetic we talked about earlier, English language, grammar, how to speak properly, how to communicate with other people. That's not the appropriate place for challenging students' beliefs. And yet we find there's an awful lot of that goes on if you read some of the literature. The idea we're going to reshape your belief system according to, we're going to homogenize our students' belief systems to embrace this Paulo Freirean type of collectivist view. This is what's going on right now. Now, the idea of challenging someone's, well, you can move into high school and say, well, let's have a look at this. Here's what the history books say. Here's what happened. Here are several different perspectives on this. Here is a standard view of American history. Here's Howard Zinn's A People's History. of the United States. And here's how he views it as a grim chronicle of oppression, et cetera, et cetera. And only that. And that's the problem with a lot of the leftist nonsense that goes under the rubric of teaching real American history. That's basically teaching you that America has lots of warts, lots of mistakes, and that's all. And the idea of the founders as being these slaveholders who had their own self-interest. You look all the way back to Charles Beard's economic interpretation of the Constitution, where he was saying, well, this document was an economic doctrine that basically enshrined the self-interest of the people who wrote it, that kind of thing. And then the problem with that is that's a perspective. The problem comes when you elevate that particular perspective to being to having place, pride of place amongst all the other perspectives. And those perspectives we don't even look at anymore. And that's the problem with a lot of this DEI nonsense. That's the problem with a lot of modern sociology and history, the new history that's being taught. I actually saw, and this might interest you and your audience, I actually had some students who, by the way, I should tell you, the syllabi on the college campus are really hard to come by in certain courses. And there's a good reason for it. Actually, I requested information from a particular course, and I was told that I couldn't have it because passive voice, it might be taken out of context. And I'm wondering, what kind of context are we talking about here that would make something that is manifestly bad look good? So I asked a student, can I have a copy of your syllabus of your history of capitalism course? Again, history of capitalism course taught in the history department. I got hold of it, I looked at it, analyzed it. I handed it to a colleague of mine who was apolitical. He's a colleague of business, you know, a colleague of instructor of business, a senior colleague, tenured professor. He comes back to me in half an hour. He hands it back to me. Says, this is malfeasance. This is pure malfeasance. What was on this history? What were the readings? Well, there was not a single primary source reading of Adam Smith. This is the history of capital. Not a single primary source reading of that of Karl Marx, the big critiquer of capitalism. Just a single book on the history of capitalism by, I'm sorry, the name escaped, Jürgen Prochnow. He's a German actor, but Jürgen, a purveyor of the new history. Basically a thin volume of about 150 pages, kind of glossing over it. And the rest of the readings were secondary sources. And as again, I said, no Adam Smith, no Milton Friedman, no Thomas Sowell, no Ayn Rand, no Karl Marx. The only book or source on the actual alternative capitalism, Soviet communism, was a book about Stalin called Magnetic Mountain, which is basically interviews with villagers who look back with affection on the Stalinist period. And this was all of the history of capitalism, not the starkness of the alternative to capitalism, which butchered millions of people, both in the Soviet Union and in communist China. So that's the kind of thing that we deal with when we talk about challenging young people's worldview. We do this, I'm using the royal we, I don't do this, but we, meaning the folks on the left, do this by presenting a worldview as an alternative to the worldview that they hold, perhaps they brought from home, but not providing any kind of intellectual justification for that worldview. We don't have any readings of Milton Friedman or Ludwig von Mises or Friedrich Hayek, the giants of free market economics, certainly again, no Adam Smith, but only Paulo Freire and certainly Karl Marx. And I'm a big believer we need to read Karl Marx.
Yeah.
Read the Communist Manifesto, which is one that people don't realize that the manifesto is one of the great publicity documents not in favor of capitalism, but saying great things about capitalism, saying that capitalism has done great things. Now it's time to move to a subsequent stage of history. And then he begins to say, this is what we have to do. And a lot of people don't realize that sort of thing. And and I've read The Capital. I've made it my task to read the great volumes of the doctrine of the ideologies that I don't agree with. I've also read, Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand, and a number of other pieces by Karl Marx, lesser known, the 18th Brumaire of Louis Napoleon, the Critique of the Goethe Program, only because this is where you find some of his aphorisms like, one of his aphorisms in the critique of the Goethe program in 1875 was this: from each according to his abilities, each according to his need. He didn't say this in Capital. He didn't say this in the manifesto. He said this in this obscure work. So to find all of these great things, you've got to read them and read them in context, not just as a pullout quote that you find on the internet with a picture of, you know, Karl Marx. So going back to your original statement that challenging people's points of view or challenging them with these challenging questions, you have to provide the raw material to come up with these two contending views. You don't simply offer Marx's view and then say, okay, now we're going to discuss all of the contending views with Karl Marx, even though you don't know what they are. And yeah. So Marx comes out looking pretty good. It really does.
So with that question, you know, isn't education, isn't it inherent to challenge people's beliefs? You're saying that not only is it not a balanced approach, but they're kind of, the faculty is deciding, or the system is deciding, what is best for these students to learn based on their own biases. And that's sort of presented as the correct answer. And that does echo my own experience in education, where critical thinking, there seemed to be no actual effort to sort of help us learn to critical think. It was all like, here, read this book and regurgitate this information. Listen to the textbook, listen to my authority. And it conditions people to just be obedient instead of to think. And I think over the past few years with the pandemic, you saw evidence that people have strongly been conditioned to obey instead of think. And it actually makes me think of someone who you're probably familiar with, Yuri Bezmenov, former KGB, yep. Who said, like, look, there's an effort towards the destruction of America. And one of the stages of that is demoralization. And it very much sounds like what you're describing on how you attack people's beliefs and morals and values. So it is, yep, quite interesting. And I hope you're correct in all this. I guess separately, kind of shifting a little bit, part of Trump's announcement was the development of the, I think it's called the New American University.
New American Academy.
Okay. New American Academy. So you've heard of this. What do you know about that? And what are your thoughts on that?
I think it's basically the idea that you're going to create, and I'm only speculating here because I've seen this in rough, and I do think it's only really in rough form, but again, it's on the table for discussion. And the final outlines of what that might look like is anybody's guess, although some guesses are better than others. And I can tell you right now, you're not going to find a lot of the woke ideology that I've been describing in that New American Academy. What you're going to find is when I say traditional curriculum and a traditional great books, classics type of education, Alan Bloom, the Closing of the American Mind type of thing, the great books curriculum you'll find at, I think, St. John's University in Maryland, again, the St. John's sister institution in New Mexico. I'm not sure it's Albuquerque. It's a great books curriculum. The idea that professors teach a lot of the fundamentals, you know, mathematics, you have a philosophy guy teaching mathematics. I have a former graduate school colleague of mine, a professor in New Mexico, who teaches that. He has to be able to teach history and philosophy and math. He has to have that kind of knowledge, that kind of Renaissance man kind of knowledge. So this New American Academy, again, I'm sure that it will slowly develop. It will suffer under a lot of criticism, this reflexive knee-jerk criticism. Oh, this is going to be like a state school. Like, we already don't have state school. We have state universities that are poorly administered right now that reflect not America, but reflect the elite views of the far left and the left, not even traditional liberals. Traditional liberals on the college campus today are in a minority, and they're considered anchoring the right wing.
Hey, do you spend a lot of time looking at screens like your phone, the TV, the computer? Well, that can actually lead to some pretty severe disruption in your circadian rhythm, which messes with your sleep, your hormones, your energy, your mood, your clear-headedness. It can actually disrupt quite a bit. Well, Boncharge has life-changing solutions to enhance your well-being and prevent some of those issues. Their blue light blocking glasses, which I'm actually wearing right now, have honestly transformed my life and even the lives of many of the people I work with. I regularly hear how quickly
people's sleep improves once they start using these glasses at night. Plus, their red light therapy devices and other wellness products offer cutting-edge health benefits. With the holiday season just around the corner, it's the perfect time to invest in your health or give the gift of wellness to someone special. Right now, there's actually huge discounts during their biggest sale of the year. So click the link in the show notes to shop and support the show, because every purchase helps me keep bringing you great guests and impactful content. What if simply mastering your breath could unlock greater mental clarity, stress resilience, and physical control? Created by Erwan LaCour, who has been on the show twice, breath hold work is a powerful meditation practice designed to push the limits of your body and mind. This transformative approach has elevated my own mindful practice and helped many of my clients achieve deeper focus and stress relief. Breath hold work offers online courses and live programs to guide you through this empowering journey, no matter your experience level. Ready to tap into your full potential? Check out Breath Hold Work through the link in the show notes. By supporting them, you're also helping the podcast continue to deliver great guests and life-changing content. So please check out the link below. Now back to the show.
In other words, a right winger on the college campus is not me. I'm considered far right, okay? No, I'm not. No, the right wingers are liberals. The folks who 50 years ago would have been, you know, against the communist speaker bans. Okay, wait, bring, you know, come one, come all. Then you have on the campus that they're the folks who are on the left and the far left, and they are increasing in numbers. And those numbers are even more egregious in the administration, in student affairs. I'll give you the exact ratio. It's 6-1 left to right in the faculty. It's 12-1 left to right in the administration and student affairs. And this makes a tremendous difference. I will tell you this: in the Chronicle of Higher Education, November 18th edition, was a book called "We Asked for." Article called "We Asked for This." How talks about the politicization of the faculty, how it affects hiring, research, and teaching, and how a new political orthodoxy is forcing and coercing faculty into behaving in certain ways. This is written by a fellow by the name of Michael W. Clune, and he's a professor of English at Case Western Reserve. And he's no colleague of mine. He's no ideologically, you know, compatriot of mine. But the fact is, he's simply saying what he has seen happen in terms of the DEI commissars, I call them commissars, trying to enforce this orthodoxy in faculty hiring sessions. You have to hire this person of color. You have to hire this person because this is the qualification that we are telling you that you need to consider. Outside of any type of expertise that is necessary, you have these people who are, I'll give you an example of what a commissar looks like. If you've seen the movie Hunt for Red October, if you recall that movie, it's about the defection of the Soviet submarine. It's a book by Tom Clancy, his first big novel. And the Soviet submarine is going to defect to the United States. And how are they going to manage this? Sean Connery is an admiral in the Soviet Navy, and he has managed to, over time, collect a crew for this super submarine that the Soviet Union has produced. All of the crew are sympathetic to his political points of view, except one person, and that's because he has no control over this person. That is called the Zompolit, or the political commissar, the person who is stationed on the submarine as his co-commander to keep an eye on him, Sean Connery. And so that person, he has to be eliminated. And that's what they do at the beginning of the movie. So if you want to know what the function of a Zompolit or someone who is, that's what the DEI folks do on the college campus. They called this guy in that I'm talking about, who was the author of this piece, and said, you've got to do this. You've got to do that. You can't do this. He's the head of the hiring committee. And this person has no expertise in the field of English literature, but this person is telling Dr. Clune that he has to do certain things. Now, that is the blueprint for how a DEI commissariat is going to behave. And this is one of the things that he also says, that there's a shadow curriculum that is being taught on the college campus that is outside the curriculum, outside the purview of what we in the faculty do. I talk about this at length in Brutal Minds. I lay it all out. I tell you what the content of this shadow curriculum is. In brutal minds, it's basically, here's what's being taught, and it's not being taught in the classroom. It's required of students, and it's this shadow curriculum. So I'm glad to see that it is surfacing in places like the Chronicle of Higher Education. Even though it was only a paragraph, it's important that Dr. Klune was alluding to this, saying that these are really instructors or faculty. These are functionaries. They're DEI functionaries who don't really know much of anything, but they're teaching these mandatory shadow curriculum seminars and caucuses and that sort of thing. And so the fact that this is coming out now in the Chronicle of Higher Education, I'm simply delighted and optimistic. One of the reasons why I'm optimistic, that we're finally getting a discussion of these things. Rolling it back, which is what I would like to do. That's in the distant future. What I am engaged in is girding and arming students to ensure that they are not attacked successfully on their college campuses, irrespective of the environment in which they find, because they have apps, they have rights, they have responsibilities, they have the ability to defend themselves. Now, this longer term reform that I'm hoping for is part of this National Academy. The fact that it's on the table, and this is what you originally asked about, is that I may be a part of that. I don't know. We don't know what the outlines are going to be, but I think that the thrust of it and the fact that we're discussing it puts a whole host of other things onto the table, because when we discuss what's going to be in this National Academy, the folks who sang over here in our current academies, like, say, the University of Michigan, Duke University, that sort of thing, they're going to say, well, we teach that too. And well, the fact is, you don't teach that too. The problem is that the reason we got this National Academy on deck for discussion is the fact that you're not doing your job, the fact that you are not governing yourself, that you have no accountability. And I think that the big, big indicator of this is what happened in the spring and on into the summer of this year with respect to these out of control campuses and their gross displays and permission of anti-Semitism. It's absolutely phenomenally egregious. And I'm delighted that the presidents of Harvard and Penn were forced to resign, and that alumni and donors and students and most faculty are looking at this saying, wow, and they're recoiling at this in horror, that we were a part of this, and we're going to clamp down and make sure this doesn't happen again.
Let's take a little bit of a shift here, because we're at this point, we're talking about kind of the future of education, and there is a pertinent topic. We know AI is exploding, and I differ from a lot of my health coaching colleagues, and I think it's maybe a generational thing, where I'm very optimistic about the future of AI. And, you know, we're talking right now over Zoom, effectively. I think we'll get to the point where, for all you know, I could be an AI-generated character and you would have no idea. All my vocal inflections, my facial expressions, the things that I say and how I say them, all of that can be eventually replicated with AI. I strongly believe that. And then it'll become a question of, isn't the ethical thing to do, if I'm this AI that can health coach everybody for very cheap, or I can teach everyone and educate them very cheap with AI, isn't there sort of an ethical responsibility to use that? Now, of course, this is potentially dangerous territory, because it's like, who's programming the AI and could it mislead people? And that's definitely a concern. But do you see AI, as it continues to evolve, playing a major role in education?
Yeah, there's without a doubt, it's already playing a major role that many, many faculty aren't real happy about. And that is in the writing of papers, students writing papers utilizing AI, which AI right now is simply really an elaborate Google search that has the capability of putting together reasonably good papers for people. And really the skill that's being developed is, how can you become a good, I think this is the right term, prompt engineer?
Yeah.
You know, how can I craft a prompt that's going to give me the product that I really need? Students are becoming very good. I can recognize, believe it or not, when students are engaged in AI, because my papers that I'm assigned, I'm well aware that you have to have a good prompt for this sort of thing. So my prompt, it requires a certain incorporation of what we discussed in class. Well, the AI folks, the AI unit, no matter how good it is, it doesn't know what we've discussed in class. That's kind of a key to it. It can take literature, it can take sources and put together really good papers, but it can't refer to anything that actually was talked about in my class.
And so that's not to interrupt you, I would push back on that because like I'm well-versed in AI. I use all the tools I've been using. I was talking about AI even before ChatGPT came out. Mm-hmm. There is new software, so I can actually use an AI tool to record every word of your lectures. I can put it into a PDF. I can feed 100 PDFs into perplexity.ai and say, think like Dr. Stanley Ridley and let's work on this paper.
What you just described is requires access to my lectures. If you do a lecture on Zoom, all bets are off. But my lectures can't be recorded. They're not supposed to be recorded. If someone records a lecture, then there's really nothing I can do about it. But that would require anywhere from 2 hours to 4 hours of recording and a lot of bandwidth on whatever device is being used. Now, I would have to congratulate a student who's going to be so good at recording all my lectures and then utilize that to come up with a project. That's a great project right there, which requires a certain set of skills, a certain skill set to do that. Your question is, what is the future of AI? So we have folks right now in my department who are researching this, and they're utilizing AI, to generate an answer. Then they're utilizing that answer to be generated again, analyzed by AI in numerous iterations to find out what the boundaries are, to see how well AI can learn from this type of thing. For some of my classes, I've utilized AI. I've already asked the question, utilizing the prompt, okay, you're going to be required to do a paper or project. I go on a particular, say, school, analyzing Duke University, analyzing Lehigh University's strategy. I ask ChatGPT the question that I'm asking them, and I generate the response, and I provide that to them. I say, okay, base your presentation utilizing this as your fundamental document. And so it kind of undercuts a little bit of what they're doing. And I want some, and if they use AI to generate some unique aspects, some unique perspectives on that sort of thing that I'm asking for, well, then that's fine. I'm not averse to that. I don't have any kind of contagion about AI. I do think it's going to require us being faculty to think hard about the way what we assign, how we assign it. There've been some proposals that we require students to utilize AI and then think beyond that and say, how can you utilize AI to generate a tool that can then be used? And how would you then present that to an audience in your presentation? And then you say, well, we generated a tool utilizing AI. We utilized 12 iterations by constantly going back. And this is the tool that we came up with. Here are the elements of it. I teach entrepreneurship. I teach the evolution of technology innovation management. And one of the things that I talk about in there is strategic inflection point, which means that there is a development in technology that is so radically new and powerful and unknown that it requires us to rethink the way we do things. The computer was one, the internet was another. Development of lesser import might be the evolution of talking motion pictures. That was a strategic inflection point that really changed the whole motion picture industry. Standardization of personal computers back in the 80s and early 90s, when money was made with the hardware, not the software. And then it became commodified. There was a big shakeout, and we no longer have Wang computers, Atari computers, Commodore computers, Texas Instrument personal computers, believe it or not. We only have certain types of computers that are made abroad. The money is made in the software, which again is an information type of product. So now we have AI that's exploded onto the scene, I think, in 2022 in the form of ChatGPT, and that's being developed, it's improving, machine learning and all of that. So it doesn't do anyone any good to be a Luddite and say, we're going to try to come up with regulations to control this technology, because that's not going to work.
Yeah.
You have to come up with ways to prescribe, not proscribe its use, but to prescribe how it will be used and to anticipate and learn from students who say, look, I would appreciate some suggestions from you on how we might utilize this tool for our class. That's the kind of thing that students love. especially those in the technology fields.
I actually have an idea that you might appreciate. So obviously AI can be used to make people lazy. You know, they can, you know, use it to not think. But for those who are interested in actually critically thinking, one thing that I've experimented with, I didn't really understand one of the planks of communism, the abolition of private property. And I wanted to explore that a little further. So I asked ChatGPT to look up Ayn Rand, to look up Karl Marx, and to, on that particular topic, simulate a debate between those two people. And so it actually went back and forth, and they gave their strongest case for their position. And if I was ever uncertain about anything, I would say, okay, well, focus in on this piece and elaborate on that, each of you. And so I get to basically talk with these people who I would never otherwise get to talk with. And it's actually pretty fun because you could do the same thing. I spoke with a vegan medical doctor and I spoke with a carnivore medical doctor. I did the same thing to prepare for those interviews. And so it's very interesting, but I know we're getting close to time here. So what else have we not talked about yet that maybe we should?
Well, I think it's important to talk or think about the Great Awakening, what the actual presidential election said with respect to, because the choices were stark, and it's not simply the choices between the two personalities. It's choice between the working class, the traditional American constituency that some people have stereotyped as being white working class, when actually it really has been the Trump coalition has been an amazing coalition, a multicultural a coalition of Hispanics and to a lesser extent Blacks, Asian Americans, and the white working class that has formed around what have in the past were traditional Democrat values. The idea of being the party of the working class, being the party who represented those who created America's wealth versus a kind of a hodgepodge of kind of a fake coalition, I think, based on race, class, and gender. And I think which was exemplified by the idea that we're going to take this patchwork, identify them explicitly, and then have special Zoom meetings of White Dudes for Harris and other identifiable groups of people utilizing this identity politics, sharpening those differences and separating them out rather than just, you know, what we see or hear is this inclusivity we keep hearing about. We're not going to have this inclusive group of folks. We're going to have this exclusive groups, these groups of folks. I will tell you this, is that I think that one of the biggest cultural, I would say, events that we have not looked at as a cultural event was the Bud Light situation.
Yeah.
That is a business case that is waiting to be written. The idea that you take a Harvard-educated woman who sent her to get her MBA at Wharton School of Business, same place that Trump got his undergraduate degree, but she got an MBA from one of the top three business schools in the world. And she ascended to the position of head of brand marketing for the Bud Light brand, the most popular beer in America, if not the world. And then off the top of her head began to speak the same way she probably spoke at Harvard and at Wharton, talking about it kind of a social engineering experiment, not talking business, not recognizing one of the most fundamental things that we recognize as a kind of what's fundamental in business is that brands are not inclusive. Brands are exclusive by definition. It's why we have brands. It's kind of the difference between the kind of the range of toothpaste we have here in America and the fact that the old Soviet Union had one toothpaste. North Korea today has one toothpaste. It's in
Cuba too.
Cuba, it's an inclusive brand. It's kind of like the Uber inclusive brand. We have one type of toothpaste that everyone can enjoy. Whereas you have all this waste and mismanagement in capitalists where you've got Crest and Pepsodent and a host of other toothpaste.
Colgate, all poisoned.
Yes, you've got minty, watermelon flavored. You've got large, you've got breath freshening, you've got cavity fighting. So the same way with beer. You've got people who are drinking Bud Light for a reason. They identify with the brand, whatever that brand happens to be. And she comes out with a statement. I think her name is Alyssa Heinerscheid. Came up with a statement, well, the brand is too fratty. I've never heard that before in my life. And I'm not a great beer drinker, but I've never thought of Bud Light in that. And if you look at the people who drink Bud Light, you look at the commercial, no, it's not a fraternity type of beer. And so this was the flimsy basis that we're going to experiment and we're going to have a transgender person who's going through a transition be the spokesperson for Bud Light. I mean, you would think if it were, say, Monster Trucks, you know, or you were going to have this person be the spokesman for Pabst Blue Ribbon Beer, or have this person be the spokesman for Ford F-150, you would kind of, well, this is kind of absurd because the brand is not inclusive. It's exclusive. And if this is your spokesperson, what you are telling your audience is that we don't want you drinking our beer because this is the persona that we're advertising with. It has nothing to do with justice. It has nothing to do with either favoring or not favoring. It has nothing to do with bigotry. It's pure business. And if you wanted to create, if Bud Light wanted to create, Anheuser-Busch, a beer where this person could be the spokesperson, you create a new beer. Create a new beer. And you sell it and you advertise it, and that's what it is. So I think that this moment really captured the divide that was exemplified in our presidential election. And the rejection of this type of woke nonsense and the fire, she was fired, and the guy who hired her and put her in that, he was fired as well. And this kind of exemplified, if you want to choose to go this direction, you can do that, or you want to go in this direction. That's American people. That's a choice that America was given on November 5th. I think that's kind of it. I said the Bud Light version of the election on November 5th. I happen to think that that holds a lot of great lessons for us of what actually happened. We see a lot of firms and business abandoning their DEI woke ideology, recognizing it's anti-democratic, it's anti-meritocracy. All it does is stigmatize folks who are hired under the aegis of this DEI program. It stigmatizes, unfairly stigmatizes them in the sense that, oh, DEI hire. I mean, I don't use that terminology, but that's terminology that's coming. And what does it stand for? It stands for didn't earn it. Well, is that the kind of stigma that you want to place on people? Or do you want to have have a meritocracy? And I use that term. That's not a term that I use. It's a term that the critics of capitalism use. Do we want to hire people in a way that takes advantage of their unique contributions to help us create wealth in our business, whatever that business happens to be? And when we hire, say, a Hispanic, a female, or a Black man, or a Chinese man, or a white person from Appalachia, we know that we have someone who's going to contribute to the success of our business. And that person has no stigma at all.
Well, that actually really helps because I was thinking of having Dylan Mulvaney represent my company, but maybe that's not the best.
Have at it. If that's the brand you want to portray, you know, that we're in transition and the best transition that we know of is Dylan Mulvaney.
Well, Stan, thank you so much. I'm going to have to listen to this a few times. There was a lot of valuable information here, but where can people find out more about you and your work?
Well, certainly from my book, Brutal Minds, and you can find that on Amazon. It's in all three popular formats, Brutal Minds in hardcover, Brutal Minds in Audible, and Brutal Minds in Kindle. I from what I talk, it's very popular to get all three as a kind of collection. And there's the book. Thank you. Thank you for that, Mike. You can also go to my website, brutalminds.com. That's brutalminds.com, one word. My articles that update my observations on education. I do focus on higher education and the scourge of DEI in higher education, brutalminds.com. And I am on LinkedIn, and I have a large number of followers and a large number of contacts. And if you're interested in what I have to say about education, don't want to miss a single post, reach out to me on LinkedIn. And I'm happy to connect with you.
Yeah, that's where you and I first connected. I highly recommend following him on LinkedIn, getting the book. Again, if you follow my show, you know about Bernays. I talk about him the most, but this is a must read for anyone interested in this topic. And even your website, Brutal Minds, you have some great articles there. I know you share them on LinkedIn also. So follow his work, but also stay healthy, stay awake. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple, or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought, or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake, or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy. Stay awake.